Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Volker M. Welter, professor of architectural history at UC Santa Barbara, and the author of several books, including Biopolis, Patrick Geddes and the City of Life, Ernst L. Freud, Architect, The Case of the Modern Bourgeois Home, Walter S. White, Inventions in Mid-Century Architecture, and Tremaine Houses, One Family's Patronage of Domestic Architecture in Mid-Century America, along with many articles. And he's also received grants from the Getty, the Paul Mellon Center, and the Canadian Center for Architecture, among others. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start by asking you about this interesting figure, Patrick Geddes, who was the subject of some of your earlier work, who had studied biology with T.H. Huxley in 19th century Britain, and had a wide variety of interests. And I believe he was called the professor of things in general by, I think, Lewis Mumford, who was an important person for kind of conveying his influence. He had, it seems, these very original ideas about town planning and things like this. And what really struck me about learning a little bit about his ideas was that when I hear something about town planning today, let's say here in Dallas, it's often presented in this extremely or entirely kind of quantitative, technocratic, rational way, that it's a question of you count how many cars move past at a certain hour and that's how big the road needs to be, or how many people will live here and that's how much space you need. But it sounds like Geddes had a much broader sense of what a town or city is. And I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about where his ideas came from and what was important about his work. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is very interesting that you actually go back to sort of my very first proper sort of academic project, because that was obviously the studies for my PhD at the University of Edinburgh. And I mean, I came across Geddes somewhat accidentally, because I wanted to originally do the PhD on something with German expressionism in architecture, and maybe something on Bauhaus architecture or Bauhaus modernism. And when I discussed this at Edinburgh University, what I was going to do with my advisor, Professor Ian Boyd White, then I mentioned sort of in passing that there was this Scottish town planner who had designed the core of modern day Tel Aviv. He did a master plan for Tel Aviv in 1925. And that's when Ian Boyd White sort of told me that would be a good topic for your PhD. And I must admit, initially I had not really an idea what I was getting into with Patrick Geddes, but as it happened, I was very quickly very much fascinated by him, because he is not a town planner in the sense that you just explained, we're dealing with width of streets and the amount of cars which we can channel through street junctions and basic numerical facts about towns. Right. And I think Geddes, and this was what really caught my attention, that Geddes comes really out of an thinking in the Scottish Enlightenment about what actually makes a good human society,
right?
A civic society with civic responsibilities. And that's where Geddes basically said, look, we have towns and we have cities, and cities for him were communities of human beings, which sort of create a civil society, a civic society. And so he often describes himself as a city designer, somebody who would design a city. When he talks about designing a city, he's again not talking about sort of the how many houses, how many apartments, how many or flats, as they call them in Scotland. But he talks about sort of what cultural institutions are necessary. How can we sort of care for the spiritual well-being of citizens, of even of citizens of different beliefs? How can we sort of ensure that the city is in harmony with the hinterland, with the region? So that's the kind of approach he had, where his knowledge from biology and then him moving into sociology and eventually into this emerging field of town planning, where he sort of has this very idiosyncratic approach, which basically guaranteed that he was an outsider within the profession for almost his entire professional life.
So the profession was already sort of not in that
Well, I think, in the late 19th century, obviously, the profession of town planning begins to emerge. And
right.
we have Geddes proposing in Scotland, sitting initially in Scotland and then later in London, proposing his sort of regional an idea of city design as creating a civic society. We have
yeah.
Ebenezer Howard in the United Kingdom, who was a stenographer in the House of Parliament.
Yeah.
And he then came up with the idea of garden cities as his response to the sort of endless reports and discussions in the House of Parliament about the working class crisis and the
yeah.
misery of working class areas in cities. So we obviously have, in the beginning, lots of people moving into this area of emerging town planning who did not have a background as a town planner. I mean, we also have architects moving into this field. And I think for Geddes, the difficulty or where it became challenging for him and also for colleagues is that colleagues, especially when they were trained as architects or came out of statistics or out of economics,
right.
that they, of course, were used to deal with the hard facts.
Right, right.
Whereas Geddes sort of comes with this idea that there is biological life and you have to create certain conditions for the life to thrive,
yeah.
environmental conditions. And he, as a biologist, he was interested in very small organisms. And then when he, for various reasons, could no longer do this, for example, he could no longer study on microscopes.
Mm-hmm.
He then essentially shifts the scale of his study. So he moves away from single cell or small, very small organisms, which you have to study through a microscope, and he moves onto a scale of his fellow human beings, where
yeah.
we can study each other without necessarily
right.
having to have sort of a technical device.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where the difficulty for Geddes lied, was that he was working on a scale, working with ideas, and they were, to an outsider, I think they would have appeared to be all over the place.
Right.
Because he may have talked about economics, then he moved on into ecology in the early
right.
ecological thought. Then he might have speculated about inheritance. Is it Lamarck or is the Darwinian? I mean, he
right.
was a Darwin
yeah.
supporter. So he could move effortlessly from one into the other.
Yeah.
But his... And it was always or very often tied to then making planning ideas,
yeah.
a new park to create a new neighborhood. And I think for a proper town planner, somebody who has this sort of technical background, it must have been quite unsettling that this gentleman comes along and sort of has all these ideas. But in the end, I think, and that's when I described him as a sort of an outsider. I mean,
right.
he knew everybody, he was on the right conferences. But he often lost his planning commissions, or he lost out in competitions to other town planners.
Yeah.
And he, when he does actual plans or comes up with city plans, city ideas, he often also simply put them into motion and then sort of said, look, here we can have an architecture school, we can have an art school, we can start certain initiatives, and then the local population, the local university, the people who live locally in the city, they can then pick up these ideas and they can take them and run.
Yeah.
So he was kind of initiating things, injecting
right.
ideas, and then he was happily off to the next place
right, right.
and left you as the local person or regional people to deal with these ideas.
Got it. You mentioned you mentioned a moment ago that you've done your doctoral work in Edinburgh and so forth. And I wondered also if someone comes to visit Edinburgh today or one of the other cities you mentioned, Tel Aviv, where are there things, if you come as, say, a tourist, are there things that you would notice that reflect the impact of his
mm-hmm.
kind of work
mm-hmm.
still today?
I mean, to start with Edinburgh, that city, if you go to Edinburgh today and you read in tourist guides about Edinburgh, printed ones or on the web, I mean, sooner or later the name Geddes will pop up.
Right.
Because he did have, significant impact sort of in the physical fabric of the city. And if you know a little bit about the physical makeup of the city of Edinburgh, there is the old town,
right.
which on one end sort of is bracketed or with the castle rock on which the actual castle sits, and then the Royal Mile, the high street, sort of goes down that Old Town Rock, and at the other end is the palace, the Holyrood Palace. And at the top of this, just below the castle, that's where Geddes actually built a huge complex, a big arts and crafts complex of student housing. So he initiated very early student housing projects in Edinburgh, but also apartments for himself and for other professors and artists. And then right next to it, there is a very interesting institution called the Outlook Tower. And that still exists today. Today it's an entirely tourist attraction, which has a camera obscura on top, which it already had when Geddes owned the tower. And I mentioned earlier that at some point in Geddes' career, he had real problems with his eyesight and could no longer study single-cell organisms through microscope. And then he shifted onto the scale of human beings and human societies, sort of looking at human urban societies, rural societies in, if you want, a regional laboratory setting. And so the Outlook Tower was a really interesting device which he developed. It was kind of the equivalent to the microscope for the biologist. And it was a several-story tower, which was an older Scottish building. And then in the 1850s, it had been extended, 1850s or 60s, and the camera obscura was put on top as a as a tourist attraction by a lady who was called Short, was her family name. And then at some point in the 1890s, Geddes took over the tower and he kept the camera obscura. And there were two staircases in the tower, a central one and a smaller one. The smaller one is no longer existing. And you were supposed to walk up the smaller staircase with, I believe it was a spiral stair. And then you came up to the top of the tower, heavily sort of trying to catch your breath, which was the deliberate attempt to get you there and to get sort of your your body really physically working. And Geddes then always claimed if you get into that kind of state of, I'm struggling for the word, of sort of physical excitement, simply because you're panting, you're trying to get breath. He said you're specifically perceptive then for impressions, visual and sense impressions. And so the first you went onto the top terrace, which was a viewing platform, and you could view over the city of Edinburgh, and then you could look into the region of Edinburgh. So you could look towards the Pentland Hills, and then in the other direction you would look towards the Firth of Forth, where the water goes into, runs into the land. Then you were supposed to step into the small building which had the actual camera obscura. And then you see essentially the same image, but now, you, of course, you see the image sort of reflected through the lens, through the mirror, onto the viewing table. And of course, sort of in the reverse, which has to do with the physics, how the view goes through the lens and the camera, the lens and the camera and the mirror onto that viewing table. And then, so you were to studying exactly what you just seen. In reality, you now were studying an image of it. And then you were supposed to go into the first floor below the viewing platform, and that floor was dedicated to the city of Edinburgh. The next floor to the city, to Scotland as the region. Then there was an area which was dedicated to the British Isles and the English language, essentially the British Empire. He never really called it the British Empire. He called it the English language, or some kind of euphemism. And then eventually at the end, you would, at the lowest level, you would come to the level of the world. So it was kind of a reverse microscope, whereas a microscope obviously takes something small and enlarges it so that you can see it. The Outlook Tower took something sort of small and made it ever smaller in relation to these expanding geographical frames of references. And Geddes, for him, this was looking at a city like this through an outlook tower was essentially the beginning of becoming aware of the city. On each floor, he had, let's say, physical models of the topography of Edinburgh or of parts in Scotland. There were historic maps, historic engravings, photographic surveys. And so you could, on each level, you were supposed to engage with the position of Edinburgh within Scotland, Edinburgh within the British Isles, for example. Edinburgh within Europe, Edinburgh within the world, and so at the, and from geographical points of view, and there were literature, there were images, and so and at the very end of the Outlook Tower, at the lowest level, on the level of the world, there were this wonderful globe of there was a globe of the Earth, and then there was a second globe which had the sky painted on it. So you got sort of on the cosmological level, and then there was a small thinking cell in this lowest level, which was basically a small room, totally darkened with curtains and just a chair in it, and that was it. So you were going to get in there to meditate about all the impressions, and then you were sort of finally released to leave this Outlook Tower. And then when you went out through the main door, which gives access to the main staircase, which is the one you would use today if you were to walk up and down that tower, then you were suddenly on the high street of Edinburgh. So then you're back into the real city. But Geddes claimed you would be almost a transformed, better human being who would then be energized, sort of energized to go out and to become active as a citizen in the community. And that was for him sort of really important. And so this Outlook Tower still exists today in Edinburgh, and if you then start walking down the Royal Mile, and you read up a little bit, you can actually then see traces of his urban interventions. There are lots of buildings where he may have put up a new building, or he added some sculptures to an older building, or there are certain carvings in stone door surrounds, sort of things which remind you of different historical periods of Edinburgh. So you could literally walk down the entire Royal Mile and you could study every single historical period of Edinburgh. So, and then on the other side, of course, if we now go to Tel Aviv, that's where Geddes was invited in 1925 to produce the master plan for Tel Aviv. The connection between Geddes and the Zionist movement as it was then called, Palestine or British Palestine, that is partially came about through Weizmann. Who was the key figure in the early history of Zionism, but who also was, I think, a chemist, if I remember correctly, at Manchester University. So Geddes knew Weizmann through their natural science background. But Geddes also had connections with others with Jewish intellectuals who later became Zionists. There's Israel Zangwill, very famous Jewish playwright, who was very fascinated by the urban renewal work Geddes had done in the 1890s and the 1900s in Edinburgh. And Zangwill later became a supporter of Zionism, and there was David Eder, or David Eder, E-D-E-R, who was a medical doctor and the first British psychoanalyst in the Freudian tradition. And Geddes knew also Eder, and Eder also became a big figure in early Zionism. So that's the connections, how Geddes got in contact with the Zionists. And when, after the Balfour Declaration, towards the end of the First World War, which essentially granted the Jewish people the right to return back to Eretz Israel, to the land of the forefathers, then the question was for the Zionists, how can you actually settle this land quickly, take in a huge number? There were obviously ideas that there are large numbers of Jewish people are interested in moving back. And if one reads up the letters in the Central Zionist Archives, the correspondence about this in the archives in Jerusalem, becomes pretty quickly clear that the British Zionists, who by that time had sort of taken over from the German Zionist movement to run the international Zionist movements, because the Germans obviously were no longer after the end of the First World War, they were no longer, did not have the political power, they were not politically acceptable at all. It was pretty clear that Geddes came into this because he offered an expertise. As David Eder writes in one letter, he says, Geddes is really good because he looks into the future, but he also is very much aware of the importance of history and the importance of the past. And he can actually deal with sort of both sides of this equation. And that obviously the Zionist project was, of course, recreating a new nation state for the Jewish people, but it was also a nation state which sort of claimed to have deep roots in the history, the biblical history of obviously the Jewish people, sort of this being their first homeland, and then they were expelled and now they are returning. So it was this kind of intellectual sort of setting which Geddes bridged. And then Tel Aviv existed outside of Jaffa since 1909. There was a small suburb founded outside of Jaffa, which was Jaffa was a mixed Jewish, Arab, and sort of Christian town, one of the oldest cities in the world. And out of this suburb, which was called Tel Aviv, then the city of Tel Aviv grew, and it had grown sort of with small neighborhoods being created here and there next to the original Tel Aviv suburb or neighborhood. And then in 1925, the idea came. Geddes was essentially on his way to India, where he had a professorship for sociology. And so he was going forth and back between the United Kingdom and India. And then the Zionists asked him to produce a town plan for Tel Aviv. Geddes produced, I think, one of the most interesting town plans which come out of the modern town planning movement. I mean, this is 1925, so we have already in Germany, obviously, the Bauhaus. We have Le Corbusier sort of creating very interesting architecture at that time in France. We have in the Netherlands, we have the modernism, this style and out. So this is all sort of becoming visible in Europe, that there is a real new architectural movement. And at some point in an article I wrote about the town plan of Tel Aviv, I'm sort of saying, you know, Le Corbusier had a really hard time to realize his urban visionary cities in the 1920s. It comes much later that he could actually build a city, Chandigarh, or contribute significantly to a completely new city. Geddes, sort of actually his city was built, the city of Tel Aviv. And he was a very interesting town plan. He basically takes the territory which runs parallel to the Mediterranean coastline and is essentially north of Jaffa and extends to the north of Tel Aviv. And there is a river, the Yarkon River, which sort of comes from the east and goes into the Mediterranean. So that's the core territory which Geddes plans. And he sets up a network of streets which essentially run from north south, but the main artery streets, the main streets of this plan, they all pick up streets coming out of historic Jaffa. So he literally sort of says, you don't ever have to plan a new street. You just have to look at an existing street and sort of extend that street, and then you will most likely pick sort of the paths people tend to travel. And then he has east-west streets, and so he creates kind of rectangular super blocks, which are essentially oriented more or less north-south, parallel to the Mediterranean coastline. And then each of the super blocks and then has sort of with four streets surrounding a super block, then have access streets which lead you into the center of the super block, where Geddes planned a small public space, let's say like a rectangle cut out from the internally cut out from the rectangle, which is the super block. And then you have at the edges of the super blocks, you have two rows of housing. So you have one row of housing, single-family housing, which is accessible from the north-south or the east-west streets. And then internally, you have a second row of housing, and they have to essentially go through short passageways into the inner part of the block. And then they access their houses from the public space. So he sets up the city, which has really interesting like a network of walking paths. You can walk the entire city of Tel Aviv. You only occasionally have to cross a major street, which obviously today has car traffic. His idea was that this would be a city which has two-story houses, and there would be lots of gardens, and the people could engage in flower gardening and also in vegetable and fruit gardening. What makes Tel Aviv so fascinating, of course, is that when Geddes did his plan in 25, and eventually it began to be implemented, and then we come into the early 1930s, and of course then we have the German people voting Hitler into power, and anti-Semitism, which then begins sort of with Jews being kicked out of Germany, being kicked out of Europe, and that obviously exaggerates or accelerates with the beginning of the Second World War and then the Endlösung or the Holocaust. So there's this massive influx of refugees into the territory, and there is a very rapid buildup of the city of Tel Aviv, as there were other areas in then Palestine where lots and lots of people had to be accommodated. With those refugees, of course, Bauhaus architects come to Palestine, or students, Jewish students, students who were at the Bauhaus, I mean, come back into their home country. And so that we have this Geddes town plan, and the architecture in Tel Aviv, in the core of Tel Aviv, is what the Tel Aviv is called Bauhaus architecture.
Right, right, right.
So which is essentially white cubes with flat roofs. I think for Tel Aviv, more of the architecture, I think, is probably inspired actually by Le Corbusier, because there were, of course, also Jewish students who were studying in France or in the Netherlands. But in Tel Aviv, it all goes under the sort of the brand name of Bauhaus architecture.
Right, right.
So the influence of Geddes in Tel Aviv, I think, is far more subtle.
Right, right.
One has to really know about his town plan. But he, for example, suggested in a certain part in the town, there should be a concentration of cultural institutions. Like a theater and a music hall. And if you know the city of Tel Aviv and you know, for example, where the Habima Theater is and the big concert hall, then we are exactly in the territory where Geddes imagined that's where the cultural institution should be concentrated.
Huh.
So the influence is definitely there, but it is probably less visible as it is, for example, in Edinburgh.
Right.
And you basically have to know about this earlier history of Tel Aviv.
Okay.
But if you... And this was what fascinated me the first time I actually was in Tel Aviv. I was absolutely captivated by these Bauhaus architecture. I mean, I was an architecture student in Berlin, but I was also puzzled by the plan of the city, because it was not one of these modernist plans one knows them, for example, from Siemensstadt or some of the Onkel Tom's Hütte, these great social housing estates of 1920s modernism.
Right.
Whereas, and this was really puzzling for me, always this contradiction.
Right.
And that's obviously when I started working on Geddes, then at some point it became clear where this tension actually comes from.
Amazing. Yeah, because so, I do think that the Bauhaus Tel Aviv is very famous, but it seems like probably the history with Geddes is much less obvious, as you say. This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Volker M. Velter. When we come back, we'll talk more about modern architecture and urbanism.